Hey Optimists, it's been such an honour to speak with so many inspiring guests over the last 10 episodes, and this podcast has enjoyed some wonderful variety in its topics and themes. The format may have evolved, but the underlying principles of progressive, inclusive leadership and conscious capitalism have remained throughout. Much has been said of ESG, impact investing and purpose-driven business in recent years, but rarely are found grassroots living examples of companies and leaders who truly embody the forces for good that these paradigms really offer. It was therefore truly serendipitous that my path crossed with that of award-winning CEO, B Corp ambassador, speaker and author Paul Hargreaves at a leadership peer group meeting chaired by a mutual friend. Having listened to his heartfelt account of his journey to build a sustainable business that can make positive impacts on society and the environment, and thereafter immediately purchased and immersed myself in his books, I knew that I'd found the real deal, an authentic exemplar of the leadership this world needs more of. So please join me now in this inspiring chat with Paul and hear how he built Cotswold Fair as a purpose-driven business that values planet and people alongside profit. And don't forget to like and subscribe to this podcast in your favourite podcast app. Thanks. Hello and welcome to episode 11 of the Chief Executive Optimist podcast, exploring conscious capitalism and inclusive leadership and helping you high performers to preserve your sanity and humanity in this time of relentless change. I'm Gareth Hawkins, scale-up coach, investor and principal consultant at Enterprise Insights in London. And today I'm speaking with Paul Hargreaves, founder and chief executive of Cotswold Fair, a specialty and fine food wholesaler he started in 1999, which today supplies to nearly 2,000 retail outlets across the UK. Paul has grown Cotswold Fair as a purpose-driven business that seeks to reduce poverty, injustice and environmental damage by balancing the needs of people and the planet with the pursuit of profit. Paul is also a B Corp ambassador, having achieved certification for Cotswold Fair as a B Corp in 2015. And he's also a respected published author who writes and speaks on how business can make a positive impact on the world by redefining what it means to be successful. So welcome, Paul. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me and look forward to this.
Yeah, well, me very much too. And I hope that was an adequate summary of your achievements.
Yes. I mean, there's probably more, but we'll come on to that as we go through, I guess.
Yes, indeed. And I hope you'll share with our listeners the most recent achievement that you briefed me on pre-pod today. So congratulations for that. So, Paul, in your first book, Forces for Good, you've published two now, I believe?
Yes, that was the first, yeah.
Yeah, so Forces for Good, your first book from 2019, you describe your journey from your early career in sales, deciding to leave that and start a charitable trust that served the underprivileged in the Deptford and Southeast London area. And then your happy accident of co-founding Cotswold Fair, which ultimately took over your life and caused you to relocate when your co-founder left a short while later to return to Civvy Street. And then on through to the recent past as you learned on the job to become a business leader and to shape that business into a vehicle for making the world a better place for all stakeholders. Now, you're not one to do things by halves by the sounds of it.
No, I'm not a safe, risk averse person. So tend to go whole hog whatever I do.
Yeah, good. Well, I mean, in order to change the world, one has to take some risks along the way. So I think you're an exemplar of that. But for those among our listeners who might not yet be familiar with your origins and your journey, might you first please just spend a few minutes sharing with us your memories of particular challenges that you faced along the way building Cotswold Fair and how and why in around 2014 you made the changes which set the business on its path towards the success that it now has today?
Yes, you're right in highlighting 2014 as a significant year in changing direction. But to get the full picture, we need to go back to the beginning. So as you said, I was working in the charitable sector. And I guess some of what I'm going to say now is from hindsight and reflecting back on it. But I was pretty frustrated because charities, in effect, are repairing damage. And the mess that businesses and governments have made. So yes, we made some progress, but B, there was also a lot of frustration about the lack of change. We work in a very deprived area, a lot of drug addiction, huge unemployment. And I think now, if only there were companies there that could take people on under their wing and make a difference to their lives. Because really, if people are employed, it gives them that kind of solid base they can then change their lives from. And not enough companies still, actually, but certainly back then, not enough companies were prepared to do that. Or companies like Timpsons, for example, who take on 10% of their workforce comes from prison. People weren't really doing that back in the 90s. So I was forced to come out of that, the money ran out, so simply put. And I had, prior to the launch of Cotswold Fair in 1999, I had for many, many years before, well, a few years before that, I had been on the side, as well as the main thing being the charity work, I had been buying some products from artisan producers in the Cotswolds and selling them to a few local shops in London, you know, less than one day a week that took. It got to the point where either I had to do it properly or stop, and met another guy, as you mentioned, who lived in Reading, called David, and we started the business in 99. Now, he was very much aligned with me, fortunately. So we did want to make a difference as a business, and we took on, of our first five employees, actually there was one person who just come out of a drug rehab unit, another one who's same unit, alcoholic, and someone else who came out of prison. So we did start with very good intentions. Now looking back on that, probably a little trying to do too much too early.
Incredibly ambitious. I mean, having that percentage of your workforce from people recovering from various issues in their lives, and that's incredibly noble.
Well, it was noble and probably slightly naive. 60% is probably a little on the high side.
Yeah, wow.
So we still do that today, actually, but the percentages are lower. And we did, you know, there was, to some degree, we achieved success. Certainly the food and drink that we were selling was going well. The business grew fast. And after a couple of years, as you mentioned, my business partner decided to leave. Actually, it happened when I was visiting some friends in China who were running an orphanage over there, and I'd really was attracted by the idea of moving over there. My kids were quite young. I thought it'd be fantastic if we could move there as a family and they could learn Chinese, etc., etc. So on the plane on the way back, I decided I was actually going to give the business to my business partner, David. It wasn't worth very much. I wasn't being terribly generous in those days. We weren't making a profit. But unfortunately, while I was away for those 3 weeks, he'd come to the conclusion he wanted to go and get a job. So he was like, you don't want it? Right, okay, I'll have it back. And I think back in those days, yes, we were doing some good stuff or trying to. I don't know if I was really convinced in my heart of hearts that business could really be a force for good and make a positive impact in the world. And partly because of that, over the next few years, I got caught up with the usual pressures of a startup business, running out of money, mainly to pay suppliers or even not having enough money to pay the wages some months. I'm sure you know the situation. A lot of
familiar story.
You know, rapidly growing small businesses have these problems. So I fell away really from our initial purpose. Those initial three people had gone by now, and really was kind of floundering around a bit, really, just focusing on growing the business, and didn't have that sense of purpose, didn't really have that conviction that business could be a force for good. And cutting a long story short, well, the first thing actually was in 2011. So I went over to a place in Western Kenya, which we've been involved with since then, took my daughter with me. And I'd been to some poor parts of the world before, but nothing had had such a big impact on me as that trip. And ditto my daughter, actually. She would still say that that's affected the course of her life as well. I was absolutely just blown away with the poverty and very, very emotional. Came back to the business, not really being able to talk about it for a couple of weeks without crying.
And of course, this is a man that had seen a lot of Western poverty. So it wasn't that you hadn't been exposed to underprivileged people, but it's a different level altogether when you go to East Africa.
Yes. Isn't it? Yeah, anyone, in my view anyway, anyone in poverty in this country is rich compared to this place in Kenya. And we eventually managed to get some words out when I came back. And someone who worked for us at that point part-time said, tell you what, why don't we do a fundraising ball? I will give my other 2 days of my life to organise this ball, which is what we did. In 2012, we did our first ball. And again, to some degree, from hindsight looking back, but it did bring a kind of new energy into the company, having a purpose outside of selling food and drink, all the normal business stuff, having something, doing something good, energized certain people in the company, and they got really excited about what we were doing. And there was this kind of feel-good factor that came into the business that we hadn't really had before. Anyway, that was going alongside. In 2014, as you alluded to, we did have a huge meltdown. We put in a warehouse management system, went horribly wrong. Customers weren't getting their orders. If they were, they were getting only half the products because the system didn't know a lot of the products were in the warehouse when they actually were. So it was an absolutely horrendous, horrendous time. I thought the business was going to go under. Certainly lots of our customers did because they stopped ordering from us. Suppliers lost trust in us. And about half, we had nearly 50 people at the time. Over the 6 months around that time, about half the people in the business actually left because it wasn't a great place to be.
My goodness.
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't a great time. I felt terrible. I was losing sleep, which I hadn't. I'm fairly chilled and laid back most of the time, but I was not sleeping well. And it was a horrible, horrible time. Looking back on it now, I would say it's the best thing that ever happened for two reasons. One, it was the jolt I needed to bring purpose back into the business. It was really, really clear. We didn't know where we were going as a business. And I started to do something about it after that. But possibly more significantly, it made me realize that I hadn't connected my purpose to the business.
Which is not easy to do when you're up against it trying to run the business.
No.
There's typical story of businesses that want to start to make a good social contribution to the world is that they've achieved their profitability targets and have the resources to do so. So trying to slot that in, as you were, to an early stage business could not have been an easy task, especially if one then has other operational challenges to overcome.
Yeah. And what I would, looking back at myself, then I was running around like a headless chicken. I wasn't really taking time to reflect on what I was doing, which I would strongly advise people to do. Even if you are incredibly busy, taking that time to step back, reflect and work out what exactly you're doing rather than just this mindless activity we seem to get into in the West would be a great thing to do. And I certainly wasn't doing that. So this kind of jolt forced me to, you know, I didn't think the business was going to be here in 3 weeks. So all my identity really was as CEO of a kind of rapidly growing business. You know, I probably didn't, it's a bit of a cliche, but it was definitely true. I didn't really know who I was as a person, certainly hadn't connected who I was to what we were doing as a business. So that whole process probably, I'm saying it in a couple of minutes, but it probably took the next kind of year, 18 months to that really to make a difference and changes. And I found out about B Corp the following year. I thought it sounded a bit of a strange name. It sounded a bit American, actually. My first reaction was, not sure about that. But when I looked into it, I thought, actually, this is exactly what I believe business is all about. And here are a load of other people really believing what I believe in the heart of hearts about business and making a really big impact on the world. I didn't know there were so many other people who believe this stuff. So that then kind of set the course for Cotswold Fair to, you know, change, develop. Our culture massively changed over the following 2 years, and we've never really looked back. So we're growing even more rapidly now than we ever have before, but it's all so much more connected to us. People are coming because they want to get involved with what we're doing, they believe in what we're doing, and it's all, and we're not saying we're perfect, we're certainly not, but there's a lot more connectivity within the business to a being a business as a force for good.
It interests me that the business had to walk through fire in order to come out the other side and rediscover its sort of original values or purpose beyond survival and profitability. Have you thought about the correlation of that sort of near-death experience for the business and how that galvanized you to get back to your original beliefs?
Yeah, and it is actually quite a common story. I've talked to a number of other people who who had been through a similar experience. Actually, I think, as I said before, I think it probably was more significant for me as a leader, as a person, to disassociate myself from what I was doing to who I was. So I think a lot of business leaders I've talked to would say that the fire, as you describe it, is sometimes a necessary process in order to change. How do we change otherwise? Probably quite slowly. So the kind of jolt of a situation like that can, you know, can bring about more rapid change, I think, sometimes.
But how many were you employing at the time?
Well, we were running all our own logistics at the time. So I think it was about 45.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And did you find that galvanizing effect of rediscovering the values and the purpose of the business was more widespread than just you and your senior leadership team? Did it galvanize throughout the business at that time?
Yeah. So initially not, but initially it was me driving it, and then a bit later the leadership team were on board with what we're doing. I would say it probably took 2 years to kind of fully integrate that cultural change into the business, by which time we'd actually outsourced our logistics. So we had a smaller group of people initially to work with. As I said, a number of people left, and the people that came in were much more on board with what we're doing. So that helped shift the dial. But yeah, it was definitely at least 2 years to, I would say, that we kind of completely changed our feeling of the business, the culture of the business.
So you alluded earlier in the conversation to the transformational trip that you took to the Barla Children's Centre in Homa Bay County, Western Kenya, which impressively now seems to care for over 400 children, 100 of which are orphans that actually live in the centre. How did you come by this charity in the first place, and what was your motivation at the time to work with them over others?
Well, they weren't actually my first choice, because when we did get to a position of having some profit and wanting to do something with it rather than just spend it, I did actually write initially to three or four food-based charities, UK-based and worldwide, to see if we could help them. But I didn't just want to give money, and that's really all they wrote back was to say, yeah, we'll take your money, but no, you can't really get involved. And I wanted something that we can't, yes, we would raise money, we would give money, but we also want to get involved, because I knew from probably my charity days, I knew if people could, from the company, could get their hands dirty and make a difference in somewhere like that, it would not only be personally massively fulfilling, but it would also change the business too. So I knew of this organization through some people who lived locally to me in Cirencester in the Cotswolds. The trip in 2011 was really just to go out and see if that was the right direction to go, and obviously came back and yes, it was.
And how interwoven is the Barla charity with the work that Cotswold Fair is doing now, and what sort of interventions have you been able to help them achieve through your partnership with them?
So that first ball I mentioned in 2012 raised enough money to start a farm over there, which we did, put up some greenhouses, bought some cows, and did something quite radical for the area at the time in terms of the cows were much higher yield cows in terms of milk production. So that my aim of the money we raised was always to put it into projects that would help them make their own money, if you like, which is a lot more sustainable than just bunging them cash every month.
Yeah, the old adage, teach a man to fish and all that.
Yeah. Now, there are challenges with that, and things have gone wrong with the farm, and more recently, due to climate change, we've actually had to shut most of that down because it's become impossible to do what we were doing due to either flooding or drought. Even me going 10 years ago, everything was very predictable. So I planned my trips based on when the rainy season wasn't, because they could say, well, it's going to come on within 5 days of April the 21st or whatever. That's all changed. It's all gone to pot. But that was the original rationale. How involved are we? Yes, we're still very much involved. We are also now involved in charities in the UK. We've done four of those fundraising balls. We're doing another one next year. There's regular money going over there. A number of the team have been. Some of our suppliers have been over I think I've been about 10 times in total, generally taking people with me each time. So yes, we are involved. I'm a trustee of the charity, but it's not everything we do. It's just one of the, it's our kind of outside the UK project, if you like.
Yeah, it sounds like a very close involvement, but as you say, one of many that Cotswold Fair has been able to deliver, which is fantastic. Coming back to the point that you make in the book, I mean, I recommend anybody to read Forces for Good, because you very eloquently kind of extrapolate the microcosm of Cotswold Fair to the macrocosm of this evolving, progressive, globalized role that increasingly purpose-driven businesses are playing in addressing or helping to address environmental, societal, individual, human challenges, and how achieving such a mission can reward the companies themselves through improved commercial success and reward their leaders with a more fulfilling work life. Some of our listeners are inevitably at the helm of their own companies, and they might be listening, wondering how they could ever hope to achieve meaningful, positive change for people and planet without taking their own eye off the ball and incurring negative consequences within their businesses. There's only so many hours in the day to devote. What advice can you give them on that, and how best to structure their organizations in order to make sure they devote sufficient resources to each of these goals?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure it takes your eye off the ball. I think it's, that implies that the real nuts and bolts of the business are is the money, and everything else is very secondary. I might even put it differently to how I did in that book. I probably talked in the book, because I thought in this way in those days, that it was about balancing people, planet, and profit, like a juggling act, which, yeah, is true. Probably these days, I would say, if you really focus on people and planet, then the profits follow. I've kind of changed a bit on that. I mean, it's not, there's lots of other people saying the same thing in different ways. What business doesn't want to look after the people? You know, this is the thing that absolutely amazes me, that some businesses don't want to look after their people. Why wouldn't you? They're the ones that are, if they're happy, enjoying work, getting enough pay to take home, feed the families, they're going to do a good job for you. Yet so many businesses seem to be, well, the very word human resources says it all, really, doesn't it?
It does, brother. Yeah.
It treats people as resources to extract as much as possible and pay them as little as possible in order to, well, it just doesn't work like that. And, you know, even more so post-COVID, I think things have, the dial's definitely shifted.
Oh, most certainly.
And more in recent years on the planet, you know, customers don't want to buy from businesses that are extracting again from the planet and are not putting stuff back. I mean, I heard this week actually that there's quite a big movement started this year as an anti-Black Friday movement, yeah, by independent retailers, which I'm absolutely in favor of, because we don't need this excessive consumerism, and the general public don't want it, most of them anyway. And I think things have moved so far forward in the last couple of years.
Although, alas, I fear that decision may have been based more on profit than other motivators by those retailers who just haven't got anything left to give away. You know, they're under pressure to make sure they're competitive throughout the year. And
maybe
it's difficult to engage on.
Yeah,
Black Friday.
Although independent retailers, I know, because they're a customer base, have actually had quite a good pandemic in many ways. Even the ones that couldn't open, the non-food ones couldn't open, they've done really well online, quite a few of them. So I don't, yeah, you may be right in some cases, but I think there is a move towards better quality stuff that isn't damaging the planet, that will last longer, and this kind of quick trash consumerism is, most people aren't buying into anymore.
Yes, and I think that's very much a generational thing as well. I think the Gen Zs and the Gen Alphas are caring about the provenance of the products that they buy more than perhaps the Boomers and the Millennials have. But and the Gen,
even they are changing though. I mean, my dad sadly died this year, but even he was making some conscious consumerism decisions. He was 86, so
wonderful.
Yeah,
living your values.
Well, he did read the book.
Ah, there you are then. So let's turn to B Corp if we can, because I mentioned, yep, in our introduction that you were an early advocate for B Corps and businesses becoming B Corps. You were one of the first 60 companies in the UK back in 2015 to achieve the certification and get B Corp status, which I understand is absolutely no mean feat. So 6 years on from that, what would you say is the biggest impact that being a B Corp has had on Cotswold Fair?
Biggest impact for most of that time was definitely helping everyone who works for us understand why we did what we did as a business, and also stretching us. I'm not sure if you know, but each time you certify as a B Corp, which we've recertified twice, so we've done it three times in total.
They raise the bar, don't they?
Absolutely. And it's helped stretch us and do stuff that we might not have thought of doing otherwise. But yeah, people are really on board with the stuff that B Corp puts into the company. So we've got the way we brought in that kind of cultural change I mentioned earlier was to set up what we call change groups within the company, which we had five groups looking at different aspects of what we're doing. There's a community one, a couple of environmental ones, a people one, and then there's a kind of general innovation one. And the only rule with those groups was no one on the senior leadership team could be in the groups. So the change really that those groups came up with, the ideas they came up with, was really coming from within the company. So that's probably the biggest one. The question I used to get asked on podcasts a lot is, you know, how has it got you extra customers? And the answer for five out of those 6 years was actually it hasn't at all, because retailers are notoriously only looking at the single bottom line of profit. That said, we have seen a number of larger customers coming to us in the last 18 months. And that's, again, during COVID, I think people are reassessing how they make their buying decisions. So, yeah, we have, as the only B Corp that's only wholesaler that's a B Corp in any sector, actually, not just food and drink.
Is that right?
Yeah. I keep looking at the list on the website to see if there are any others appeared, but can't see any, which is odd in a way, because the whole nature of a wholesale consolidating business model is actually carbon reducing.
Yeah.
So it's a shame not more. I mean, I've actually offered help to one of our competitors to certify. The more that are, the better for the greater good.
Pass in your opinion?
I don't really know enough about them, but I think their heart's in the right place. Yes, the bar's higher than it was when we certified, but I think any business that's looking after people and doing what a lot of businesses are doing will get a certain way, and then they probably just need to do another kind of 25% on top of that to get over the B Corp line. So
is there a particular defining quality or characteristic that a business needs to have at its core in order to sort of guarantee that it would achieve B Corp status?
I think a lot of people that became B Corps, as same for us, was there probably had to be something in the company, something in the DNA of the company that wasn't just about making money. So a lot of food and drink businesses, there are more food and drink businesses than any other sector actually that are B Corps. And I think a lot of food and drink, they do it for the passion of what they're doing, especially in the kind of specialty end of that market. So their first, yes, they need to make a profit, as any business does, but their first priority really was to make good, sustainable food in a way that isn't cutting corners. So a lot of that ethos is definitely going to help you get somewhere. And, you know, a lot of my friends who run businesses, they're good at looking after their people. We've always had, there's five kind of sections of the B Corp assessment, and one is the workers. And, you know, a lot of companies that treat people well and always have done, some haven't, of course. But the ones who, yeah, they know it's a good idea for business to treat their people well, they will certainly get certain points on that will put them in a good place. But there's different businesses that would have different strengths. You don't need to be perfect to be a B Corp, but you need to be good enough in each of the five different areas to get enough points to get over the line.
B Corp's been on my radar for a number of years. Increasingly in recent years, I work with a number of startup and scale-up companies, and the pursuit of achieving B Corp status almost seems ubiquitous now amongst the startup ecosystem. Every business that seems to send me a pitch deck includes an aspiration to achieve B Corp status, regardless of sector, which is wonderful. But one of the key elements within becoming a B Corp, one of the key criteria, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that you have to change your articles of association to run the company for the benefit of all stakeholders rather than just the shareholders.
And yes, that's right.
If a founder has an aspiration to IPO or you know, make a public listing in some way, does those articles changes preclude them from doing so?
No, I mean, I think there's three or four parts of Unilever that are B Corps. So Pukka Tea is a B Corp that got taken over by Unilever, didn't seem to hinder that. Body Shop, the same. Ben & Jerry's, of course, well-known B Corp that, again, got bought by Unilever. So no, I mean, the thing is, a lot of smart investors these days are investing in businesses that have a purpose.
Yes.
And that's where the smart money is, actually. Probably, maybe not for making a quick buck in 2 or 3 years, but the investors that look out after family trusts, they're all investing in sustainable businesses because they know doing this stuff is going to make more profits in the long term. Maybe not even the long term, the medium term. So I do think that things have changed massively in the last few years. And then what you said is really encouraging, actually. I mainly look at the food and drink sector, but if you're looking at across different sectors and everyone seems to think they need to be a B Corp to get traction, I find that incredibly encouraging. And maybe one day there'll be legislation anyway. I mean, I'm trying to push for the Better Business Act to go through Parliament at the moment, which will in effect change the Companies Act to make it a legal necessity for businesses not just to make decisions based on profit, but to take account of people and planet as well. So obviously if that goes through Parliament, won't be this year, probably not next year, but say 5 years, we could dream that would be in law, then every business would have to do this in their decision making.
That would be tremendous. I mean, clearly these businesses are trying to ensure they have a future relevance and that relevance is interwoven with the viability of the planet, which is, you know, a very noble and admirable pursuit. I don't know if engagement needs to be forced by statute. You know, perhaps market forces are the best test.
Yeah, I'm in two minds on that, to be honest with you. Yeah, it's got to be, it might be both, but certainly it's got to come from business first. I mean, the other thing, of course, is that the good people, really good people in Gen Y and Gen Z, they're going to want to work for companies like this anyway. So if companies aren't heading in this direction, they're just not going to get the best talent. And that's massively been true for us in the last 18 months as well. We've taken on some fantastic new people, and they've left potentially more better traditional careers to come to us because they believe in what we're doing. And that is going to be more and more true the more of those generations are in the workforce, which is, I think they're nearly over 50% now anyway.
Yeah, and it's that pursuit of meaning from the daily work that we do, I think, that that's only going to amplify over the subsequent generations. And I think that's another market force, ultimately, not just consumer market force, but the employment labor pool market force that will drive more and more businesses to think, I have to have a global societal environmental mission at my core. You write in your book about leadership. In fact, you speak quite frequently on the topic of authentic leadership. And there are some real key leadership lessons that you convey, not only in Forces for Good, but in fact, your second book, The Fourth Bottom Line, it serves as a compendium of characteristics and daily reflections for leaders who want to lead with purity and humanity. And I think that's kind of commensurate with the fact that these old leadership qualities of confidence and dominance in the boardroom are kind of giving way to an appreciation of authenticity and virtues-based leadership, which obviously you exemplify. What was the greatest lesson that you've learned in your journey and your research about how best to lead in today's world?
Learning compassion is probably the big one. So all the stuff I've said about B Corp is, you know, a lot of companies, the ones you talk about, they can decide to do the right thing or a good thing and set their intentions, but that will run out of steam unless it's somehow driven from inside us. It'll run out of steam. We can't do everything. We can't carry on. I don't think good intentions without a deeper resilience will work in the long term. So being driven internally by love, can I use that word in a business setting? I think
please
we can
do.
These days. Yeah, will be the thing that gets us over the line. And a big turning point for me, a story I've used many times, is when I was in a room of people and talking about planet profit motif and put a slide up on the screen of some people have been washed out of their homes in Bangladesh. And I was just completely overcome with emotion. I thought, what on earth is going on? Anyway, got through the talk. And then afterwards reflecting, I thought, what on earth was happening there? For me, that was the point at which climate change became real. The stuff we've done over the, not just ours, previous generations is actually washing people out of the homes and killing people, and has done for years. And that kind of impacted and resonated deep within me. And from then, I've definitely had more energy and more passion to make changes in our business in that area. And I just don't think you can do those profound systemic shifts without that internal drive of love and compassion.
Have it at the core and don't let anything beat it out of you, I guess, is some lessons to be learned there. But you mentioned about becoming emotional by something that contextualizes and anchors all of this sort of broad brushstroke, high level conversation about climate change and seeing how it actually really is affecting lives and ending lives. I think it takes those real tangible examples to bring it home to people. And mentioning about becoming emotional on that level, I remember a talk you gave that I was lucky to be present at recently, where you also exhibited a lot of emotion around a particular scenario that played out in Cotswold Fair, where I think it became apparent that your team were very much strongly living the values. If you want to share the anecdote about the chef and the bicycle.
Ah, yes. Yeah, so we set up a new business this year, but in effect becoming one of our own customers. So set up a food hall and a restaurant over in the Bristol area.
Which is already hugely successful, I understand.
Yeah, no, it's gone really well. I mean, we're fortunate that it opened just around the time of the last lockdown. So people were desperate to get out and eat out. So that definitely helped us. But I guess one of the things I was most nervous about that was, you know, we were taking on doubling the size of our team, and was all the good things that have evolved over the last few years at Cotswold Fair. How easy would it be to kind of, in a totally different site, start again and make sure those values were there? Helped massively by attracting the right people, as I've just mentioned. So it was really pleasing to me when soon after we opened, before the first wage run had happened, one of the butchers found out that one of the chefs was actually walking 5 kilometres to work because he'd run out of money to pay his bus fare. No one knew this apart from when it came out. And so he gave him his bicycle. And this is a really small thing, but that was, yes, there's some good stuff here. Right at the beginning of that business, people are thinking like people, not cogs in a machine, and this bodes well for the future of this business. And there have been a number of other things like that have happened since. So it's really encouraging to see. My fears actually were totally unfounded in a way, because it's almost like that new business, because it is probably the average age there will certainly be a lot lower than the wholesale business. They're almost ahead of us, of the wholesale side now. So, really encouraging to see that they're behaving like a family at work, which is encouraging.
And leading and acting with love and compassion for their fellow colleague, citizen, human, call it what you like.
And again, this is good business. It's not just, there's a bit of icing on the cake. No, customers notice this stuff. I mean, even my kids noticed when they came. My son lives in the USA, and he was back a few weeks ago and went for lunch there. And, Dad, everyone seems really happy here, don't they? It was like they, for the first time, they actually got what the hell have been going on about for the last few years just by walking into the place. So, this stuff rubs off on customers who then obviously want to come back for more.
Well, let's hope that it is infectious and that it is an exemplar that people take back into their own businesses. Speaking of which, it would be remiss of me not to ask you whether there are examples of particular leaders who you admire, who exhibit the sort of values that you want to see in leaders? I mean, be it of one-man startups through to multinational corporations, who do you look to and think, wow, you're an example of the kind of leader that there should be?
Well, unfortunately, and this is an interview question of mine, that who has most inspired you in your business career? And very few people can give a good answer to that. I've been doing my own thing for a lot of my life, so probably not fair. But for me, the answer to that question was a teacher at school, actually. My most inspiration in terms of leadership, as you know, if you've read the book, it comes from people like Nelson Mandela and Gandhi and Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa. Those, you know, they're not business leaders per se, but I think as business leaders, we can learn as much, if not more, from people like that about leadership than we can from some of the less good examples we have in the business community.
Yes, quite. So a bit of an indictment of the business community that you look for examples of good leadership outside of it.
Yeah, I mean, there are people now. I mean, a friend of mine, Ed Perry, who's one of the founders of Cook, and Mark Cadogan, who's CEO of Ellis Kitchen. They would also be two people I've got to know through the B Corp community that are massively inspiring and run great companies too.
So no doubt the business practices that you extol have come an awful long way in the last 50 years, and business continues to evolve towards more of an enlightened future, albeit at sometimes a glacial pace. What do you think's the greatest challenge to a more widespread adoption of virtues-based leadership style, where vulnerability and humility and integrity are valued by all stakeholders over the delivery of pure growth and profitability and a company's share value?
I've been thinking about this recently. In fact, I read a book over the weekend on a Swedish word called lagom, which in effect means enough, as far as I can work out. And the word comes from the Vikings passing around a cup and making sure there was enough for everyone to have a sip of mead or whatever they drank at the time. No idea. And this is particularly appropriate probably for entrepreneurs, and I know it's true of me, that we're always striving for the next thing. If you know, ambitious people, even, you know, corporate people in careers, they're never satisfied with where they are now. They always want more. And obviously there's a good side to that, but there is this sense, certainly in the kind of global north countries, that we're never satisfied with what we've got. We always want more, and actually more doesn't bring happiness. And these myths that are propagated on social media, that, you know, we will be happy if we have this, or we'll be happy if we do that. No, happiness comes from within. I think as Western business people, if we could learn to be content, and, you know, there is good scientific data, you know, most the people are at their optimum happiness with a salary of around £65,000, and you don't get any happier when you get more than that. But that's not believed by most people, is it? We all have this sense that we're never, you know, we could be happier if we had more, and actually you won't be. So it's about redefining success. You know, we've had an incredibly successful couple of years as a business. I haven't actually taken out a penny more out of the business. I don't need it. All our profits are going into other things and investing in new projects and more people and stuff like that. So I think we could learn a lot from those who, you know, those non-business leaders I've mentioned about this. I think it would absolutely revolutionize our businesses, and probably they would become more profitable and more successful as a result.
And have a great improvement to the lives of the people that work in them, if they're not constantly being, you know, whipped to achieve ever increasing targets and KPIs.
Yeah.
I mean, that said, you know, the idea of lagom in business probably goes against consumerism, because, you know, we are all kind of driven to want the next thing and more of, and shareholder value kind of expects continued growth and continued, you know, inflation of a business's success, measured purely in you know, EBITDA and net asset value, which is, as you say, quite short-sighted. If we could see greater KPIs around global impacts, you know, societal and environmental impact, that would be tremendous.
It doesn't make you less competitive, though. The Swedes obviously embrace Legom. They're the sixth most competitive nation in terms of business success. They work less than we do. They give 480 days of childcare for children up to eight. You can have 480 days off. And yet they're incredibly successful, entrepreneurial people, and often, as I'm sure you've read, that come out as high up in the happiness index, certainly happier than the USA or the UK. So they've got something right there, and they are good, successful business people at the same time.
Most certainly. Examples for us all to follow. Well, I hope that this podcast has proved to be Legom in some fashion. but before we wrap it up, we ask all of our guests to give us an insight into their hopes for the world of tomorrow. And I think I can probably predict where you might take the answer to this question. But if you will, could you please share with us sort of your hopes and wishes for humanity and the world of tomorrow, what it might look like in, say, 5 to 10 years' time?
Okay, well, we're recording this soon after COP26. So I've been struggling with trying not to get too angry about COP26 for the last week, particularly when I found out that the fossil fuel industry had the largest delegation of people at the conference, 503 people lobbying on behalf of the fossil fuel industry. So it's my number one would be the end of the fossil fuel industry. That's not too much to ask. And we need to get serious about this stuff. And it was good to see Alok Sharma showing some emotion, because clearly he cares, and he's actually our local MP actually too. So that was good to see. I think, and we're hopefully going to be one of them, that there's going to be a huge move to employee-owned businesses. Now, there's, again, good data that they are the most successful businesses. And the great thing about those is it empowers the disempowered. We need to change the way we view the world, I think, as business leaders, and make it a lot more about empowering those within our organizations. Yes, we can pay them more, etc., but the real power comes from ownership, and a lot of people in the UK and all over the world don't own stuff. It's very unfairly shared out. So businesses that are employee owned, I think, is going to be a massive growth thing over the next few years.
And that's really interesting, because it correlates a lot with what I'm seeing at the startup level. I mean, many businesses now from the get-go are thinking about option schemes, EMI schemes, that sort of thing for their staff, and making sure that they are thinking with one eye on the future for how they can ensure an element of employee ownership, involvement, skin in the game. I sincerely hope that's preserved when they get to the sort of VC level of investment, subsequent Series A, B, etc. But I think new generations of founders and leaders are thinking in those terms. And sort of testament to your humility, sir, as a multi-award winning entrepreneur, you have not taken my cue and shared with the listeners your most recent success and achievement. So congratulations to you on winning your award this week. Would you like to give us a bit more information about it?
Yeah, so it was the Great British Entrepreneur Award. There was lots of awards. So I was at an awards event last night with 1,200 people there, and one of the prizes.
Congratulations.
Which is great. I mean, in some, yeah, great to be recognised. But in some ways, I'd much rather, it's the only award I think we've won that's really about me. I'd much rather the company won awards, because any award like that, it's clearly, it's all to do with the people that work for us. So I did say that when I let them know on the team meeting this morning. Yes, it's got my name on it, but really, you all know I don't do very much anyway, so it's all down to you.
This one's for you, team. Yeah. No, that's great. And as every award that a founder wins always should be. I'm sure Cotswold Fair's got its fair share of awards and will continue to win numerous going forward for the great contribution it makes, not only to its market, but to the planet. Paul, it's been absolutely humbling to hear of your values firsthand and to hear your heartfelt account of how you've built Cotswold Fair and the values that you live and have engendered in it. It's incredibly motivating to watch your example of what is a vastly successful commercial company founded and grown on a platform that puts the environment and social responsibilities at the heart of its mission. I'm sure it will have helped many of our listeners to hear contextualize true conscious capital in action. We talk about it, but very rarely do I get to actually see a business that is built and founded on it. So thank you very much for sharing that with us today. I know that you do a lot of speaking and public appearances. How would our listeners get in contact with you if they would like to engage your services?
So for that side of my life, it's best to go to paulhargreaves.co.uk, and that's my kind of speaker author website, and you'll find contact details on there. And also if you want to read one of the books that you've mentioned, that's how they can get details there too.
Yeah, I'll actually make sure that we post some links to those books in the show notes so that listeners can download them or listen to you. I think there's one of them that you're actually narrating the audio book, isn't there?
Yeah, I narrated both of them actually, which was incredibly hard work because I've got to stick to the script, which I don't normally do. So, as you might have noticed in this podcast, but...
Well, that's what podcasts are for, is a bit of freestyling. So, okay, great. I'll make sure that the link to your website is also in the show notes. Paul, we wish you many years of continued success, and we thank you for continuing to be an engine of change, spreading awareness of the much-needed progressive business practices that hopefully will become the norm in the decades ahead. But thank you for joining us today, and look forward to catching up with you again in the months and years ahead.
Great. Thanks for having me, and thanks for pushing out these messages, because they are so important.
They are indeed, and I'm sure they will become self-promoting in the very near future. So all the best, speak to you soon. Paul is incredible, and his books are recommended reading for any business leader who wants to be the engine of positive change in the world. I've linked to them in the notes for this episode, and I hope you enjoy them as much as I did. If this episode resonated with you, please let us know, either via LinkedIn, on Twitter at GPG Hawkins, or via email to podcast@ceoptimist.com. And if you have a recommendation for a future guest who leads with their values, please do reach out. In our next episode, we'll explore the topic of B Corps further, hear more about the process for becoming one, and learn how new startups can establish themselves on a B Corp footing in order to receive certification at inception. Until then, remember to live with intention, make choices based on your values, and not let the choices of other people define you.